Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I represent Israel Aguilera. This morning I'm presenting argument on behalf of both appellants. Your Honor, this case arises from a, I believe, unquestionably warrantless and unconstitutional search. The district court found it was warrantless. It was, in fact, warrantless, and cases are very clear that a warrantless search of a residence is presumptively unreasonable. The issue is whether the evidence seized should have been suppressed. It is our position that the Supreme Court's decision in Grove...
Let me tell you what my main worry about your argument is. It doesn't look like the lack of a formal warrant played any role, any causal role here. Suppose the magistrate judge had done what he was supposed to, kind of swivel around in his chair, type the details into the formal warrant and sign it while the police were out in the field making their search. Nothing would have been any different.
Your Honor, my answer to that is that the same can be said of the Supreme Court's decision in Groh against Ramirez. Nothing would have been different had the itemized list of items to be seized, had they been included in the warrant that Agent Groh got in that case?
Yes. And but look, Groh is not a case about the exclusionary rule. It's a case about damages. And we know from Hudson against Michigan, the Supreme Court has said there's a category of things, maybe a large category, where the plaintiff may be able to get damages, but not exclusion of evidence. And Hudson says you don't get exclusion unless the constitutional error was in the causal chain. It caused a search that would not otherwise have occurred. That's the question I'm asking here. Is the error one that caused a search that would not otherwise have occurred?
Well, Your Honor, what we do know is that the search occurred, there was no warrant. We can speculate what would have happened. As we point out in our...
We know what would have happened had there been compliance. That is, the magistrate judge would have entered the stuff and signed it, the step he forgot to take. And the search would have gone on.
Well, Your Honor, I think we need to be clear about who would have done what. The magistrate judge is not, because the United States tries to push this towards the Shepard versus Massachusetts kind of argument, or at least the district court did. This is not an error of the magistrate judge. He was never presented with a warrant to sign. It's not that he forgot to swivel around in his chair and sign it. He was never given a warrant. No warrant was presented.
Well, you know, there's at least one state, New Jersey, that allows a search to proceed on verbal authorization. Couldn't an objectively reasonable officer believe and indeed conclude from the tenor of the conversation with the magistrate that the federal rules similarly allowed for a search to proceed on verbal authorization? I mean, when you take a look at the exceptionally thorough nature of the warrant hearing in front of Judge Crocker and Judge Crocker's no-holds-bar comment, you've got judicial authorization and what I recall is a rather infrequent use of a middle-of-the-night telephonic warrant application process. Can we really expect a law enforcement officer to think that the judge's words, "You've got judicial authorization," are wrong?
I think we can and we should. This court has said, the Supreme Court has said, every court has said, law enforcement officers are charged with the knowledge of the applicable laws to what they do. Groh could not be clearer, whether it's a 1983 case or a suppression case. Groh could not
Can't pass off that difference. That's the whole point of Hudson, that there's an enormous difference between whether this is a damages suit or a request for the exclusion of evidence.
Your Honor, I believe in response to Judge Rovner's question, though, it goes to the officer's state of mind. The officer cannot be allowed to misunderstand when the Supreme Court clearly says
normal here.
May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? The fire reported in the sub-basement has been investigated and is back to normal. You may return to your work areas.
That's GSA for you. First, they tell you to stay exactly where you are, and then they tell you to return to where you were.
Well, Your Honor, returning to where I was. In response to Judge Rovner's question, I think the officer, when Magistrate Judge Crocker says you have judicial authorization to search, the officer is expected to know two things. First, the Fourth Amendment doesn't require judicial authorization. It requires a warrant, which he didn't have. And the Supreme Court in Groh told him you also need an itemized list.
Whoa. Fourth Amendment doesn't require a warrant. Fourth Amendment requires that searches be reasonable. The Supreme Court has said that searches of a home ordinarily are not reasonable without a warrant.
Correction.
That's different from saying the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant. You may remember that in Groh, the Constitution says if a warrant, then it must have a particular description. There was an actual violation of the Fourth Amendment here. The problem here is that the search may or may not be reasonable, not that there was a warrant that was not on oath or affirmation or didn't have particular description or something like that.
Well, the Supreme Court and this Court have also said repeatedly that a search of a residence without a warrant is per se unreasonable.
No.
What?
Oh, certainly not.
Or, I'm sorry, presumptively.
It's a big difference.
It is, and I misspoke. It's presumptively unreasonable.
Why can't we take into account the fact that, in this case, a written warrant wouldn't have served any of its traditional purposes or functions in keeping the peace and allowing for monitoring since, you know, no one was present at the house?
Two reasons why. One, the law is clear that a search cannot be justified based on what's found as a result of the search. So you can't bootstrap and say when they conducted an unconstitutional search, they realized that even if they had a warrant, there was no one there to show it to, therefore it's okay. Secondly, if there was nobody there to show it to, what was the danger in waiting until 8:30 in the morning when the court opened and actually getting a warrant? I believe the government is trying to have it both ways here by arguing on the one hand, we were doing something out of the ordinary by waking the judge up in the middle of the night to get this emergency warrant, so we should be excused for making a mistake. And then saying, but the mistake doesn't matter because there was nobody there anyway.
Suppose it had been technically possible for the DEA to obtain a simultaneous transcription of the telephonic search warrant hearing, and that it was holding that transcript signed by Judge Crocker in its hand as it knocked on the defendant's door. Would that have been a sufficient warrant?
No, for a couple of reasons. One, the transcript isn't signed by the magistrate judge. There's no signature on it. And two, there's no list of what they're looking for. There's no itemized list of items to be seized listed in the transcript. I also want to point out, in response to the question about Hudson, this is not a case where we're talking about a technical violation of some administrative, ministerial, using the wrong warrant form like it was in Massachusetts versus Shepard, or a knock and announce requirement. This is the basis of what I believe is Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. You can't search a house without a warrant. This isn't a technical violation of some technicality. This goes right to the heart of Fourth Amendment protection. And therefore, when the government in its brief tries to make the deterrence evaluation, I think, with all respect, they're looking at the wrong factors. The fact that there was a large amount of drugs seized is irrelevant to how what the deterrence would be here.
Let me put the question in a different way. Why doesn't the inevitable discovery doctrine cover this? Right? The inevitable discovery doctrine says that you do not suppress the evidence, even if it was seized as a result of a warrantless search, if following proper procedures obtaining a warrant was inevitable. And one might think that what happened here is the very best evidence you could imagine that getting a warrant was inevitable.
Your Honor, since that the inevitable discovery issue has not been raised at any level of this, I didn't prepare that for this argument. However, it is my understanding, I may be wrong about this, and if I am, I apologize, I don't think any court has ever applied the inevitable discovery rule to a warrantless. In other words, had they done things the right way, they would have gotten a warrant, so we'll excuse the fact that they didn't have one. This was, at basis, a warrantless search, and I believe the evidence should have been suppressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lieberman. Mr. O'Shea.
The district court was correct for four compelling reasons. I should note that the strength of the government's legal position is, however, inverse to my personal dismay in failing to prepare the warrant. That said, I turn to those four reasons. First of all, there was no but-for causation between my error and the evidence found. There just isn't any, and which is the but-for causation required by the Supreme Court is really, and I respectfully submit, another way of saying the inevitability of the discovery. Secondly, suppression would be disproportionate given the scale of the error. Third, suppression would not further remedial purposes of the rule. And fourth, Special Agent Shamlack acted in good faith throughout this. And the first point, the Supreme Court in Harris and Hudson and this court in Espinoza and Stefanik have repeatedly held that suppression is not appropriate unless the evidence was seized as a result of the constitutional error. The defendants have not challenged at any point that the district court's finding that the absence of a written, contemporaneously written warrant, they have not challenged the fact that it had zero practical ramifications. The defendants cannot show now, they haven't ever attempted to show, that the evidence was seized at the apartment because I messed up. Rather, they haven't shown that. No more or less evidence would have been found at the defendant's home had I properly prepared the warrant under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 41E3. Under the unambiguous law of the Supreme Court in this court, the absence of but-for causation is fatal to the defendant's argument. Secondly, the district court correctly found that suppression was disproportionate given the scale of the error. The record shows that this assistant in the magistrate court mistakenly believed that this recording, this telephonic search warrant, was a self-contained warrant and application, and that the recording contained all the necessary elements, components to a valid warrant. I was wrong. The Supreme Court and this court have held that a contemporaneously written warrant is important for two reasons. First of all, to hand to the occupants of the home and to head off any breaches of the peace, as Judge Rovner has mentioned. And secondly, so occupants can monitor the search and make sure the officers stay within the bounds of the search. As the district court found, there was no practical ramifications here because there was no one there in the home. I just want to mention, obviously, it was the middle of the night. Government, none of the agents knew that nobody else was in the home until they actually got inside the home. So we're not trying to have our cake and eat it too. We didn't know nobody was there. Second, the absence of genuine constitutional harm is clear when the facts show, and the district court was right in finding that there was no, that the defendant's substantial Fourth Amendment rights were protected. Those facts were presented under oath. They were presented to a neutral magistrate. The location and the things to be taken were described in detail, and I would suggest that defense counsel turn to the last couple of pages of the transcript. It's clear in the defendant's appendix that the magistrate does list the things that they're allowed to take. And an inventory, of course, was provided. A sturdy probable cause foundation existed for the search, and judicial approval was given. For the same reasons, the search was reasonable. So I respectfully submit that the suppression is disproportionate. The district court was also correct in denying the motion because the court felt, I believe correctly, that suppression would not serve the remedial purposes of the rule. The rule, the purpose of the rule is to deter police misconduct. I respectfully submit not only was there no police misconduct in this case, there's no misconduct at all. I made a mistake in failing to prepare the warrant, as I've said. But that error was not...
Rule 41D3A, or is it 41E3, suggests that it's the agents in the field who should have a blank, a sheaf of blank warrants with them and fill it out and then read it to the magistrate judge by phone. It's, duty is not on the assistant U.S. attorney. The duty is on the agents.
Well, practically, the way this would most reasonably work and the way I've laid it out, look, this isn't going to happen in the Western District again because I've got a form, I've got a checklist, I've done training for my colleagues. Look, practically, the way this is going to work is the assistant U.S. attorney is going to type it up and fax it over to the magistrate. And then you know, we'll make – that's the only way, realistically, to make sure you've got the same thing in both spots. So that's why I'm not putting it on the agent. I'm not putting it on the magistrate. If just realistically how it should have happened, it would be on the assistant U.S. attorney. But, you know, look, it wasn't intentional. It wasn't done to gain an unfair advantage. In Hudson, the Supreme Court observed that the value of deterrence depends on the strength of the incentive to commit the forbidden act. Well, look, there was no incentive. I gained nothing by goofing up. I gained a trip down here, and I gained a slip opinion, which will reasonably and correctly be critical of my performance.
You gained a couple of extra minutes of sleep, just that the price may be high.
Yeah, well, look, that deters people.
Did you
and
go
that
to
serves notice.
What? Have you gone to confession?
This is it, I guess, in my brief. Well, that's good. It's good, really, because it's – look, this doesn't happen much. I've been there 17 years, and this is – you know, I've never done a warrant under 41E3, and neither have any of my colleagues. And this is appropriate to give notice to, you know, my colleagues in magistrate courts. Listen, but that gets – look, regardless of whether I goofed up or all that, that's fine. But there's no police misconduct in this one. And that gets us to the last point. And that's the good faith point. In Special Agent Chamlack, you know, he didn't do anything wrong. And I submit that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule applies for five reasons. First, Special Agent Chamlack woke me up, and he, by extension, woke up the magistrate court. He sought out a judicial intermediary, and that is prima facie evidence of good faith. Secondly, there's no indication that the magistrate abandoned his neutral role. There's no indication that law enforcement was dishonest or trying to gain an unfair advantage. The facts clearly establish probable cause. And as Judge Rovner alluded to, the magistrate court unambiguously told the agent that the search was authorized and that he could immediately send in the search team. Given the context where we've got that kind of unambiguous authorization from a highly respected judicial officer and the telephonic presence of an experienced assistant U.S. attorney, this error cannot be laid at the agent's feet. For all these reasons, I respectfully request that the district court's decision should be affirmed. I thank you for your time, and I will sit down unless there are any other questions.
No, but for the record, regardless of how this case goes, I want you to know that I, for one, am incredibly impressed with the way both you and Judge Crocker fessed up.
Well, I can't speak for Judge Crocker, but if I could have pointed at somebody else, I sure would have, but there was certainly no room for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Anything further, Mr. Lieberman?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
And I know that I'm technically already out of time, so I will be very brief. I think Mr. O'Shea hit the deterrence point better than I did myself when he said, as a result of this case, it's never going to happen in this district again. The deterrence, they get the point of how they messed up and what an important point this is. And I don't think that
don't
this...
see how that helps you. That just shows that they learn from their errors whether the evidence is suppressed or not.
Well, but I don't think the court can say that once the prosecutor comes in and says, we understand we were wrong, we'll never do it again, that the constitutional error should therefore be excused. The final point I want to make is this court would be the first court, I believe, to hold that the Leon good faith exception applies in a warrantless search. That is what the government is asking you to do. I think that is completely uncharted territory, and I would urge the court not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.